at the same time?
Sure. I'm really interested in using the storytelling projects that I'm going to be working on to talk about Black women organizers in particular, Black women artists, and having us be protagonists in stories that we're usually not protagonists in. I'm also very interested in aestheticizing abolition. White supremacy and patriarchy has aestheticized itself. It's become a cultural project, not just a political project. So I want to do the same with abolition. I want to show people that abolition is not just a theory inside a book, but it's something that we can practice, and it's a, something that is culturally relevant for this time.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Patrice Cullors, on being with us and your new book, An Abolitionist Handbook, 12 Steps to Changing Yourself and the World. Patrice Cullors is the New York Times bestselling author of When They Call You a Terrorist. She's an author, educator, artist, and abolitionist, co-founder of Black Lives Matter, and a founder of Reform LA Jails. Last year, stepping away from her role as executive director of the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation. And we will link to your writings and others as you move on. That does it for our show. We have a job opening, human resources manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, and so many more. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
On behalf of the entire KBOO community, we'd like to offer our sincerest thanks for your contribution to KBOO's end-of-year membership drive. We challenged KBOO supporters to help us meet 3 donation matches and raise $45,000. And you stepped up. Your generous support, combined with hundreds of other community radio donors, helped to raise $85,000 for KBOO. We knew you could do it. And together, we did.
Good morning. You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO.FM. 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 Corvallis, Albany, and via the World Wide Web, it is KBOO.FM. Today is Monday, the 31st of January, 2022, and you are listening to More Talk Radio. I am Cecil Prescott, and I am so glad that you have taken some of your valuable time to spend with us this morning. Again, if you're listening live, it is the 31st of January, 2022. That's how you say it, 2022. By the time I get used to saying that, it'll be 2023. But we'll keep on trying until we perfect it. Our numbers for you to call a little later on is 503-231-8187. But not quite right now. Let us spend a little time in terms of introduction and reviewing some things and thoughts on our agenda. Those of you who are listening live had the opportunity to hear Democracy Now! That preceded us this morning. And two stories that were very powerful was one on the political prisoner Leonard Peltier, and who's been in prison for 46 years. Wow. And related somewhat to it is Patrice Cullors, who is a founder of the Black Lives Matter movement and a writer of An Abolitionist Handbook. Before her interview, you heard a discussion about the policing tactics that is proposed by the new mayor of New York, Eric Adams, a former police officer. This is all related to some of our desire to have a conversation this morning, not only talking about the current state of policing, but imagining, reimagining what it would be like to live in a society where the goal would be, and remember that a long time ago, for people to form a society where all people are welcome, and those who are called criminals, those who commit harms against property and people, have the opportunity to change and to become what has been used so often, a contributing member of society. Celeste is very involved in and works around looking at policing in the state of, not the state of, in the city of Portland, and inundated by so much.
Well, right? There is a state of Portland, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay. So Celeste is going to share a little bit about who she is and what she does and set up our conversation this morning. Good morning, Celeste. How are you?
It is Monday, and I saw the sun, and yeah. I saw blue sky. So, you know, I'm not saying my bar is set low, but I'm just saying that was nice. Okay. That was really nice. I was listening to the show, and I was thinking about, you know, trying to keep it focused on where you're going. I was thinking about how we need to provide resources, you know, for people who are caught up in the situation that either leads them into criminality, or resources for them to be rehabilitated. But, you know, to be rehabilitated, to make those changes, you have to have a desire, you know, and it has to be supported by like minds. Now, let's step on the other side of this line for a moment when I say that. We talk about the need for change and reform in policing, and we talk about providing all of the necessary resources and fresh ideas for reform, fresh commitment for reform, and we have lots of ways of outlining and presenting these fresh ideas and these changes and these, you know, sweeping policies that would aid reform. But, you know, we had a situation pop up here in Portland that was recently publicized that really begs the question of what is the root of our transformation dynamic. Okay, and I said it that way because I need just for you hold on to a little bit of objective distance here. We had recently in the city of Portland unfortunate and very sad revelation that there were some very divisive, racially divisive, class divisive, in so many ways divisive slides and information that were presented in what was supposed to be a Portland Police Bureau training. And many people have had an opportunity to read about it. Maybe they've heard about it here on KBOO or other media outlets. Some of you may have gone online and seen not only the troubling slide, but you might have even had an opportunity to see the whole presentation, the PowerPoint presentation. And what was so egregious is that this information was not brand new. It is allegedly part of a PowerPoint presentation that was made for police training to address crowds, crowd control, riots, et cetera, et cetera. And it was, again, I'm saying allegedly, because, well, people are trying to suss out, you know, if that's actually true. But it seems to have been made in maybe 2018, which would mean it's had about 3 years, maybe 4 years of potential circulation among our Portland police officers who received that training. Most notably, one of the groups was the Rapid Response Team. So, the other thing that makes this egregious is the fact that we are under a settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice coming out of a lawsuit that addressed Portland Police Bureau's tendency to use too much force. And although the settlement agreement focused specifically on people with mental health issues, it's no secret that there are an unnecessarily high number of people of color engaged in that dynamic as well, or victims of use of force. Mm-hmm. And so here it is, 2022. The information was found somewhere in 2021. I believe it might have been September or whatever. It was sat upon. It was held. It was not released. And then when it was released, there were multiple gasps of shock, because we're supposed to have the Department of Justice have access to our training material. We're supposed to have a cohort of people that also are an advisory group for training material. Our city attorneys had knowledge of this and did not share it with all of the necessary groups and people who were trying to be part of the oversight dynamic. And so now everybody's scurrying, trying to rebuild trust, rebuild connections, prove sincerity, prove commitment. And, you know, it's not like we've never had this problem before. Portland has a history of racial unrest stemming from the fact this particular state did not allow slavery. And it wasn't because they were so magnanimous of heart. It was because the powers that be in Oregon didn't want the quote-unquote Negro problem. They didn't want to have to address slavery and all of its fallout and problems, because bear in mind, I think it was 1865, 1866 or something when we became a state, something around there. Forgive me, I'm not exact. I didn't think about having to have that in front of me. But the point is, blacks were not welcome in the state, to the point where you even had sundown laws and lash laws. So we're not surprised that we're having that attitude. What is surprising is that it persists. And here we are in 2022, and we're dealing with something that keeps rearing its head. And so the question becomes, not do we need more training, not what is it with the Portland police culture that allows this racism, this bigotry, this economic and class divisiveness, this unnecessary and inordinate use of force against people. But do we want to change it? And I've participated with John Kanda and Judith Mowry and a bunch of other people in various projects in the city wherein we address harms of gentrification. We had community meetings. We discussed how in the city there was market and very, very, I guess I'd say long-term efforts at destabilizing the black communities after kind of putting everybody on a reservation, known as the Albina community, after the Vanport flood. So you know that the city is not adverse to disinvestment. It's not adverse to mistreatment. The question is, though, now that once again, this really ugly dynamic has raised its head is not what do we need in terms of training or what policies do we need to prevent this from happening. Well, the real question is, does Portland really want to pay the price to remove this kind of pervasive attitude from its policing, from its public safety, from its community safety, and from whatever else is sustaining this bigotry and this racism? Does Portland want to pay that price? Because everything comes with a cost. Well, what is the cost, you may ask? The cost is honesty, uncovering those who are keeping it here, keeping it thriving, giving up whatever power, privilege, status that comes with being able to keep your side of the city, your side of the street, you know, free from people that you don't want to be bothered with. Is Portland really interested in paying that price? And you know, I mean, now how long have you been here in Portland, Cecil? 30, how many years? I know we've been here pretty close to the same amount of time.
Yeah, 30, I don't know.
30-something.
Yeah, 30-something.
And in the time you're here, you've been here, how long have you heard about some of the challenges Portland has had with racial unrest and racial tension?
Well, actually from before the time I got here.
So, yeah. And so it begs the question, we want to call ourselves progressive. We want to say that this city does not know and does not involve itself in classist, racist dynamics. But we know that's not true. So I just want to ask this very, very basic question that really cuts to the root of all this. Is Portland willing? And when I say Portland, I don't just mean our leaders. I just don't mean our city council or mayor. I don't just mean the police chief. I mean the ordinary people who support this. What ordinary people? I don't know, the ordinary people who want to call public safety on folks who are not doing anything that's specifically a crime. Maybe they're without a place to go and be at home, so they sit on a park bench all day. And let's just say, for the sake of argument, they're not causing any problems. They're not yelling or screaming or having a psychotic episode wherein they're not feeling safe and they're chasing away people that they feel are harmful to themselves. They're not trying to panhandle or any of the other things that we want to call undesirable activity. Maybe they're just sitting on the park bench all day. You see them every day. You don't like that. I'm going to call the police. Now, there are officers who will work very, very hard to help this person get resources with the limited resources we have. How do I know? Because I worked with them. I also know that there are some who will gleefully hit a person in the head as if that was some kind of Donkey Kong game, like they can't see the humanity of the person. But people like that can't exist unless there's an environment that allows it.
A couple of questions, Celeste?
Sure.
Sure. As you shared that perspective and that history of Oregon, related to the fact that, you know, policing seems to be a challenge grounded in, I think, white supremacy. And as you mentioned the slide early on, I think perhaps that's endemic of, you know, the society we're facing, more specifically in terms of the how that slide was prevented from being shared? And maybe you could. And so, who kept the slide from the Department of Justice? I saw a multitude of apologies from the mayor to probably to the head of chief of the police, all apologized for it. But who is responsible, and who prevented it from being shared?
Well,
that's something you're investigating.
Yeah, that, you know, and I don't want to get too deep into that.
Okay.
Because we're in kind of an informal setting here at KBOO, and, you know, we only have 40 minutes or so. But, you know, those things are important. I will say that it was members of our city leadership that made that determination. And again, I would define city leadership to include, you know, our council, our attorneys, you know, other people who head up bureau chiefs and directors, and oversight committees that are here to help. A few of them even said we didn't have knowledge of it. So that causes a challenge immediately, because these are the people that we depend on to share the information and to come up with strategies to help us improve. You know, and a lot of people want to say, well, it needs to be more training. You know, we're not training them well enough. You can do all the training you want, but if a person has diametrically opposed views, that training goes nowhere. What training has shown us, equity training specifically, is that when people see that their ideas, their political ideologies or whatever are not popular, they learn to hide them better. And in the early 2000s, there was a dawning recognition of this dynamic that later became known as microaggressions, microinsults, microassaults. And basically, these were the attempts to both hide and show, you know, hide and show, or hide and display, what could be considered, you know, racist or discriminatory behavior. Mm-hmm. And people started recognizing and uncovering this, and it has been linked to the rise of equity, diversity, inclusion, anti-racism training, all of those. And it's recognized to be a challenge when you have people who don't really reveal who they are until they feel really comfortable, and then lo and behold, you know, the proverbial mask slips, and you see that you're dealing with someone that you thought was a friend and a comrade and a believer in the wholeness of human beings, and instead is somebody who believes in, well, white supremacy, more or less.
Well, certainly, as you mentioned, Oregon is steeped in white supremacy to the very core of its being. When it was still a territory of the Legislative Committee in 1844, passed the first of a series of black exclusion laws.
Yes.
And as you reminded us, when the, Oregon became a state, and that was February 14th, Valentine's Day, okay, 1859, as a free state, exclusionary laws were part of its constitution. So it remained something that Oregon Territory and Oregon State has struggled with, and as you have illustrated for us in terms of policing. It has been a part of policing in the state and in the cities and towns of Oregon. So where do we go from here? What do our listeners view as the way to go? Celeste has, and perhaps you will share a little bit about your current participation in terms of examining policing, your current role. But Celeste has taken on the challenge as a volunteer citizen, seeking to examine and offer solutions towards policing. You mentioned, and it's always a challenge for me to remember the newest acronym. So DEI, you know, I say, okay, diversity, equity, and inclusion. DEI.
You're right.
And stuff like that. And
that's not even the latest one.
I'm sure it isn't.
Yeah.
and also you said a little bit about this. Certainly not a new action, a new development, but a new way of expressing something, microaggressions. And that seems to be a buzzword in many circles these days.
Well, first, let's remember to give people the phone number. I know I told you last week we were going to deal with a thorny subject. And one of the purposes of talk radio, you know, not just abroad, but here in Portland, and specifically with KBOO, is to give people a chance to engage and to share ideas with each other and hopefully expand mine and dispel, you know, debunk and all that kind of stuff. So here's the phone number. It's 503-231-8187. Okay, so a regular point of disclosure whenever we talk about these issues. I used to run a Department of Justice program that was a combination of law enforcement and community development. Yeah, it can be possible, and in many cities around the country, this program did a lot of good. With that, I worked under, I think, three U.S. Department of Justice attorneys. Okay. Then I worked for a while in the Office of Neighborhood Involvement with the city. And I did a lot of community organizing and helping people come together over some thorny problems. And often that would address things like gentrification and the weaponization of city ordinances and, you know, racial tension and how to deal with it with the police. And that's where I got a chance to meet some really good officers, you know, which encouraged me, because coming from a city in the Midwest, I grew up in St. Louis. I knew firsthand what it was like not to have good relationships. From, you know, fast forward to, I think it was last year, maybe so, I was appointed to the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing. And that grew out of the Department of Justice settlement agreement that dealt with the excessive use of force that Portland Police Bureau officers demonstrated against people with mental health issues. And so now I'm sitting on the Racial Equity Subcommittee. And so this group is supposed to help promote better policies, better policing, better relationships with the community, create a joint system of accountability and oversight. You've got PSEP that works with the chief of police, the mayor's city, mayor's office rather, city council, Office of Equity and Human Rights, okay? And then again, like I said, with the Department of Justice. So imagine our surprise when this slide pops out. Now, it's not just one slide, not just one lonely, aberrant slide. No, the whole piece, the whole slide deck is really suspect. And, you know, the city had posted it on its website, and you could go see it, and I guess I'll take a moment here and try to pull that up. But basically, we are trying to work with the community, like I said, to increase collaboration with communities and create a joint idea of what community safety looks like. So the apology that you mentioned came from City Attorney Robert Taylor, who was the person who stepped up and took responsibility for the fact that the slide popped out, was seen, and that it was not shared, you know, in a timely fashion with our Department of Justice attorneys and the members of the various collaborative groups. And it's caused a lot of distress and dismay within the city. But, you know, we're asking all the right questions, though, because we can work on this all we want. Like I said, you know, you can have all the training you want, but if the people are not amenable to the training, if they're not interested in the training, it doesn't make a difference. And then something with this kind of dynamic doesn't exist unless there are pockets of support, or I'll just say it, pillars of support. And that means we have to ask ourselves, are we willing to dig deep enough to find out who these pillars are? And are we really wanting to hold these people accountable? And on a very personal note, that might mean that a lot of ordinary people might find their idea of status and access and political and economic comfort challenged.
Yes. So for those of you who are not aware, it's a meme that's part of a 110-page slideshow that was created to instruct police on tactics for controlling riots and protests. And its final slide, although I'm told it is not the only disturbing slide in the presentation, this final slide contains a mock prayer that celebrates brutalizing demonstrators. It's a meme that has originated in far right wing circles, and it's very offensive. The mayor said it isn't clear who created the unauthorized slide or whether it was actually used during a police training. And Celeste, you told us it was created in 2018.
Well, that's, you know, there's some conflicting data on that, and there's a there's an investigation going on. So I don't want to set any specific idea in anybody's mind. You know, it's like we're looking to find out when it was made, who made it, why, where, you know, who seen it, all of that.
Okay. Well, the mayor said that it first came to the city attention in September. Prompting an ongoing internal...
September of 2021.
Prompting an ongoing internal affairs probe. And Portland officials initially didn't release the document publicly to safeguard the investigation integrity. At least that's what they're saying. And everyone said that they are offended or disgusted by it, the mayor and others, but it is symbolic of an ongoing issue in way in which we are training police officers, our view of official view of policing, and it illustrates the tension and the difficulty of creating a meaningful relationship between police and communities. It's ongoing, and it continues to be a problem. What are some of your thoughts? Our numbers again are 503-231-8187. People like Celeste take lots of time, volunteer time, sitting on committees, and I assume most of those meetings now is video meetings.
Yeah, virtual meetings, yeah.
For hours on hours, listening to testimony. And I honor and celebrate people such as you, ordinary citizen, who try to uncover and try to find solutions around this bureaucracy.
Well, you know, I do it because I care, and I want to live in an environment where even people who may have had a criminal background and trying to step away from it have a fair chance, you know, and that we don't have people who make assumptions based on your economic status, you know, your mental health status, your physical health status, you know, color of your skin, et cetera, et cetera. Don't make assumptions about who you are and your worth and treat you badly. You know, I've got friends and colleagues who have been hurt demonstrating peaceably, you know, by officers who have a record of use of force. And I shared with you an article. I don't know. Let's see if I can pull that up. And in the article, it was, I think it was run on, it was an NPR story.
Yeah, American Life.
Yes, this American Life. And it addressed this couple finding a framed 1920s Klan application. And they are trying to decide what they want to do about this. To make a long story short, they decide to share this information because this reveals a whole different attitude and perspective on a police officer that was currently working.
And this is in Portland. It's
no, it's not in Portland.
It's in the Midwest.
Yes.
Muskegee, I think.
Michigan.
Michigan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so first they go through the trauma of trying to decide what to do. Then they make it known. Then they experience not only blowback from the community, but the closing of ranks and people in higher places not wanting to take accountability. And one of the things that struck me that I thought was really interesting was that this particular officer had a history of problematic relationships, of use of force, excessive use of force, of racial profiling, but nothing had been done about it. And you look at this and you think, how does that exist? It does not exist in a vacuum. It has support. And sometimes support is just you look the other way and you don't say anything. And I know at one of our PSEP meetings, the question was asked, you know, how long has this been going on? Who knew about it? Why was nothing said? Who are the people who have oversight? And it becomes frightening because, again, it's not necessarily that we don't have systems in place. It's that the systems that we have in place are not used to their full effectiveness.
All right. You know, one thing that, and that's a challenge because it seems to be so, whenever an incident happens, there's an investigation, there's reform that takes place, there's creation of a better accountability system. And somehow, as you suggested, they don't succeed because other incidents happened subsequent to this, the initial one. And it leads to, I think, a lot of frustration on all sides. You know, one thing I read recently was that people often talk about those of involved in policing, that there's only a few bad apples. And the response was, you know, where are the good apples in terms of calling out these officers or practices which denigrates the integrity of policing? It seems as if for too many communities, too few voices of those within the system are able to speak out to hold the system accountable. It's one thing for community people to say this is wrong, but until the system begin to implode or change from within, things will, I think, remain the same. Perhaps you have another view. Perhaps you think that things might change. Give us and have suggestions about how that might change. Our numbers are 503-231-8187.
Well, you know, here's one of the challenges. This is why I say we have to look at how far, how high, how wide this really racist attitude flows. I think it was roughly a week ago, maybe a little bit more, maybe 2 weeks. There were headlines of a police officer choking a female colleague. The male officer arrived at the scene. There was already a suspect subdued, handcuffed in a vehicle. When the male officer arrived, he was agitated, or at least let's just say that he provoked the suspect and changed the dynamic of the communication. And then he, you know, was going to tase the suspect. And a female officer tried to de-escalate this and walked up behind her colleague, who was much bigger, grabbed him by the belt and tried to pull him away so that there was no excessive use of force. Okay? This is what she did her training right. She did justice to the training. And she tried to de-escalate the situation. Okay, so because she's doing the training right, you're going to call her a good apple, okay?
Yes.
The officer in question turns around and puts both hands around her neck and proceeds to push her backwards up against the car and to choke her. Wow. So let's be human for a moment and just look at that dynamic right there. First, they're colleagues. Second, she's doing the training. She's doing the thing. Okay. He decides he doesn't want to de-escalate. And so he's going to channel his anger on her. So there you have it. Here is anecdotal, I know.
Oh,
but it is prominently anecdotal. It's right in your face. And here is somebody trying to do the right thing. You know, and you have to ask the question, okay, do the good apples not speak up because they fear harm, retribution? You got to recognize that there are some jobs where you can't go in and quote unquote just do your job and not have outside forces at play. So there's some jobs that are just political by nature. You got to walk a certain line. So, but we do have a caller. I don't want to take away from their opportunity to join in the conversation. Good morning, Robbie.
Hey, good morning. Love the conversation. Thank you for having it. Love listening to the show. I just wanted to join the conversation. Yeah, it's unfortunate. I saw somebody had compiled a list of the good apples, which were very far and few, who were facing consequences for their speaking out and trying to hold the bad apples accountable. There's like something like 9 or 10 police officers who witnessed something, and next thing you know, they're arrested, they're reprimanded, they're off the force, and it's just very sad. But with all that being said, earlier you were talking about Portland and such, and is this really a woke city and such? And I've only been here for about 10 years now. I came up from Arizona, which I'm a victim of police brutality down there. Mm-hmm. I got dragged out of my car by my hair for essentially speeding, and like maced and beaten and placed. And then they did everything. They tried to they falsified court documents. It was a real big mess for me. But I left Arizona, partly because I was an activist, and you stick out like a sore thumb there. And when I came up here, it's really funny because, I'm going to bite my tongue a little bit. People are going to hate to hear this, but I came up here and my first thought was like, wow, the police are nice up here.
Yeah. Well, that's frightening, to think, though, that we're nice up here with some of the things that people have been accused of. Yeah, that means you came from a difficult place.
I saw the police firsthand and how bad it was. And I've had to explain this to other people that, I was a punk kid, I dyed my hair and I was in Christian conservative Caucasian country, Arizona, so people were, would look at you, cause tattoos and pierced, gauges and dyed hair wasn't the normal thing. But it was funny because anytime I'd walk into a store, if there was a cop, that cop was just staring at me, just dogging me right down, just trying to intimidate me, if I walked in. But they wouldn't do that if there was a black person in there or a Mexican, like person who's speaking Spanish. Next thing you know, that cop isn't staring at me, they're staring at them. And so that was kind of like my introduction to all that. And it's just really funny because what I've seen in the last 10 years here is kind of like the trend of like, oh yeah, we got to be woke, we got to be progressive. And there's a portion of it that scares me. I can see that it's not authentic, that it's genuine. It's like I came up here and the racist family had the Black Lives Matter, thing in their yard, whereas in Arizona, they stick out. And so what I've seen and what I'm kind of concerned about is, and it's even from, it's people on the left, it's people on the Democrat side, it's like they can't see it, but like they'll be. I was out at all the Black Lives, not at all, but a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests, last summer. And when I was out there, he was an Asian reporter, kind of had like a camera, and he was walking around, and then a bunch of Black Lives anarchists were like, "Hey, Andy, no, you should get out of here, Andy, no." And then the guy's like, "I'm not Andy, no." Mm-hmm. And then they realized that he wasn't Andy, no. Right. No, he's another, infamous Asian reporter on the right side.
Yes.
They're all, you know what you're doing here, looking like him and coming out. And he was like, "What? What do you mean?" Well, I'm just sitting here and I'm like, how am I supposed to defend this side that I'm trying to be on when I feel it's just too riled up, people are too emotional. Being replaced by revenge.
Let me ask you a question, Robbie, because this is where I want to get to the crux of this. What do you think we need to do to get to make this change? Because you pointed out something. Somebody printed somewhere, held up, and tried to celebrate perceived good apples. Somebody is in power is allowing this to continue. I don't know who it is. I'm not going to guess. But what do you think we need to do as ordinary people to make a change? What are the questions or statements we need to say? And then how are we going to give up our posing? Because here in Portland, the thing is not always that you do, is how well you look when you do it. In other words, you're posing. You're not really committed to the change. And if you could just hit me with that quickly, because we do have another caller.
I'll try to make it quick. Honestly, and it's stuff that you do here, and it's stuff that honestly, that I feel, you want to, you know, you have friends that you talk to on the other side, and that's what it's going to take, in my opinion. It's going to take us talking to the people and listening to them. Why do they think this, you know, and then just sharing that conversation if we're ever going to get beyond. So that's you know, that's where I feel. It's like we can't be shunting people away. We can't be pushing them away. We should be doing the opposite. We should embrace that other side. Embrace that other side in a way that we can try to bridge the gaps of miscommunication and the misinformation. You know, it's everyone right now. It's really scary. Everybody just kind of believes what they want to believe. You know, you can turn on Fox News and believe that narrative. You can turn on CNN and believe that narrative. And right now, that's creating the disconnect where people just don't trust any other people. Anything you say is from Fox. Anything you say is from CNN. And we just don't believe each other. It's dangerous.
Well, thank you for being a voice that speaks to all of us here, our everyday people, you know, and trying to share the idea that you've got to be real with this. Don't be a poser and even examine your own views. And I appreciate you being out here and speaking that truth to the public and to power. Thanks for calling. We'll go to our next caller. I think we got Cody on the line.
Hello,
can you hear?
Yes. Cecil and Celeste, good morning.
Good morning.
I understand the subject pretty well, and I'm going to try to be quick. The police are sock puppets. They're dangerous sock puppets. They can be deadly sock puppets, but they're sock puppets nonetheless. And no one's really asking who's controlling them, because, I mean, they're human beings. I'm not saying that they're great people, okay? It's just that if you put a group of people under enough pressure, they may do things that they normally wouldn't do. So what I'm trying to say is, what's going on at the administrative level to the police department? See, we all see the police, and part of being a cop is keeping your mouth shut for the city. The city likes to hire a certain psychology so that they could do certain things, and the city don't get in trouble when they do it in front of the police officer. So that's where that paternal order
and that's exactly what I'm getting at, Cody. You're saying the very thing that I've said, is that we know this has to be
jumping on these.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm going to say, we know this has to be supported by someone in power, someone that is exercising that wink and nod, you know, dynamic.
I think it's very immature for people over a certain age to look at a cop and not ask about his training or ask about what's going on in the police department to create this type of environment. I'm not making excuses for these guys. But, police are like a civilian military. They have rank. They have to follow orders, and they have to go through a certain due process in order to stay on the force and keep a low profile and go home. And it's, you know, we done studies. I'm quite sure Cecil's aware of Stanley Milgram and Phil Lombardo, Zimbardo, excuse me, and the psychology behind groupthink and how it overshadows. So no one's asking the questions about the city level, the bureaucratic level, the type of pressure these guys, and training that's being invested in these cops.
We are. That's one thing that we do at the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing. That's what we do at the Racial Equity Subcommittee. We ask those questions. I feel like I made the shot across the bow because I asked those very questions you just did. You know? But here's what I'm saying is, we know it's not just the ordinary police officer. Because some of them are thinking, I just want to keep my head down and go do good in the community. But that's not possible because of the dynamics of the job and the politicization of the job and the weaponization of the job. So I'm asking people, how many of folks are willing to actually go to our power structure and start rattling that cage and saying,
that's the whole point.
Yes, there we
that's
go.
The whole point.
There
right.
we go.
And whenever I see police doing this, I'm going, what's the city doing to these people? What's going on?
Yeah.
What's going on at the administrative level? And no one bothers to ask that. They just want to beat up on these cops. And look, I'm not saying that I feel sorry. There are some bad people out there. It's just that I know for a fact that certain people with a certain psychology are hired on to the police force because they do display a certain psychology in some municipalities, not all.
Mm-hmm.
But in some municipalities, they want a tough guy. They want a guy with some violence in his record. Okay, this no one's bothered to ask who created that standard.
Well, but here's the thing that's fascinating, and I can only speak to my narrow experience in this particular city. Now, I've sat on the hiring committee, and I have interviewed as a part of a panel potential police officers, and I will say there have been times when I have just been profoundly overjoyed at the fact that we asked all the right questions. But for every moment, my one self was there asking the right questions with my cohort. Somebody else had to have interviewed our problematic police officers. You see what I'm getting at? Somebody opened the door. And so I'm thinking, where is the place to put the lever to push these out? Because we got to accept that there's more to it. There's so much more to it.
Well, and there is. There's a lot that's going on that unless you are a police officer or in that fraternal order, you're just completely out, and they'll just patronize you and make you think that you're making some type of difference. And the people who write the checks, it's the people at the treasurer, the city comptroller, the mayor, mm-hmm. everybody around that. Nobody talks about that. And the cops and the cops who they bring on, they don't talk about the level of nepotism that's going on, people who married in other families and all of those. That's nobody talks about that. But
exactly.
Then those cops are gonna get it all, and they're taking it all. And I wonder how long is this going to last before the police department start ratting out the city? And they say, you know what, I don't want to say rat. I want to say leaking information out to the press.
I would like to say reveal and be honest. That's what I want to say. I hear you. And those are the questions that I want to engage with people and get them to asking. Because I'm one person. You're one person. But we're not getting something that we need as a population here in Portland from these leaders, and so we got to keep pushing until we can find the right spot.
Nor will we. And in conclusion, I'll just say that even if they come before you and they say the right stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they impress you, what type of environment are you throwing them in before they do decide they want to go and become and sell out to the dark side? And I'll leave it at that.
Yes.
And let USC folks take over for that. Have a good morning.
Thank you. You know, that was it. You know, and I go, and when he said that, before they get kicked out into the dark side, I went right back to that photo and watching that video of that female officer getting choked by this big brawny piece of beef, you know, and she was trying to do the right thing. And that's what I mean by, are we willing to pay the cost? What is the cost, and are you willing to pay it? You know, and I made a shot across the bow. I'm not the only one, though. You know, there are other people who are just as concerned, but the question is, where are we going to go with this? How are we going to push it to make sure that we keep pushing until we get the right answer?
Well, I think that's part of the not only challenge, but that which continues to motivate us, because it's something that continues, and it has something that has always existed. And I don't think we'll ever reach the point where we've created the perfect society or the perfect police force. There's a lot of things we have to ask, a lot of questions we have to ponder. However, I think we become lost or defeated when we stop trying. So in whatever ways you can, in whatever manners you can, continue to do the work, continue to ask the questions, continue to say why, and imagine a better world. You have been listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO-FM, your community radio station. Stay tuned for the OMO Variety Hour if you're listening live. And thank you so much. I'm Cecil Prescott.
I'm Celeste Carey. We want to thank Ray, our engineer, for being here early in the morning, and thank every one of you that has supported your community connection, KBOO Portland. We'll catch you next week.
You're listening. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound like a broken record, but you are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Listen sponsored. Now, become a member now. Become a